Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome to the KE Report. Corey and Chad here, your hosts for our weekend show. Also your hosts throughout the week on our website, podcast, YouTube channel, and even go to our new Substack page to stay up to date on all of our daily editorials and company updates from throughout the week. Just search the KE Report, whatever service you're using, you'll find our interviews there. On this weekend show, we're going to be trying to ignore some of this volatility, actually a lot of the volatility in the markets, in the metals, in commodities, focus a bit more on what's going on with underlying stocks, bigger picture themes to, again, kind of make sense of maybe the long-term trends of the resource sectors. The first half of the show going to be focused a lot on metals and mining. Second half of the show, we're going over to energy, oil, and natural gas. To kick off the show, we are chatting with Joe Mazumdar, editor of Exploration Insights. And Joe, as I said, we're going to focus more on metals and mining here. You came out with a report to your subscribers that focused on North American listed gold producers following their 2024 results. Now, this week we did have Newmont report their Q1 results. We really just want to recap 2024 in terms of production, performance leverage, free cash flow, valuations, all these things that really matter to these underlying companies and investors. Before we get into the actual data here, Joe, give us a bit of an overview of what this work entailed. What was it based on and your thought process behind it, please?
All right. Thanks a lot, guys. So what I did was I did the same process for the first half of 2024, where I looked at these same 21 major gold producers that are, like you said, North American listed. And I went through several metrics, like, you know, what they produce, their margins, free cash flow, balance sheets, corporate costs, growth potential. And I sort of put that together in terms of saying, okay, well, who's doing well? And I also looked at just saying, okay, who did well in 2024 and who did well in the first quarter of 2025? And then I came up with a list of companies. And as we mentioned before the broadcast, is that it's a little bit of a cross-section of the different companies. So, you know, there's a few, you know, major companies like Agnico and Kinross. There's Torex in terms of an intermediate, Alamos, Lundin Gold, and Dundee Precious Metals that stood out to me based on the metrics and the returns as being companies that are offering more than the rest of their peer group.
Yeah, and you can tell that when you look at the stock charts of those companies too. They've outperformed a lot of the other producers. But let's dig into the nitty-gritty here, Joe. I guess let's kick it off with the production. What trends did you see as far as was there growth in production? And did you distinguish between growth through acquisition or growth through development?
Well, see, first I based it on like what these companies were doing in terms of their production profile. And so the top eight of that 21 peer group, they produced on average at least 1 million ounces, and they together accounted for a third of global mine production. And what you notice post Newcrest merger, Newmont has a considerable margin of production gap, competitive gap to everybody else, Barrick being the second one, and then followed by Agnico in terms of major peers. And then the other thing I'd like to point out was what had changed between the full year of 2024 versus the Q1 2025 in terms of returns. And so in 2024, the gold price was up about 26-27%. But the GDX, if you use that as a benchmark for major gold producers in terms of equity ETF that's done by VanEck, that was up about 12-13%. So it's sort of telling you that the gold companies didn't have a lot of leverage. And that was for various reasons, you know, a lot of retail buying of gold, in China and other places that didn't spill over into equities. Not a lot of US buying, especially in the first half of 2024. But that changed in Q1 2025 when the gold price went up for the first quarter. It's gone up since 14%, but the GDX went up 33%. So we're seeing more than two times leverage there with the equities. And we're seeing that return, and we're seeing exactly what people want to see. And so I took this forward in terms of those companies as I produced this analysis.
So, Joe, dive a little bit more into this production, though, because the one thing that we keep hearing is that we're not seeing production growth, which in this better environment where there have better margins, I think some investors would want to see production growth. What can you tell us about what's going on with the big miners, even with the mid-tiers, in terms of production and overall growth?
So what I did in my conclusion, let's say, it's best to come up with the conclusions first, looking at growth versus income stocks. So the generalists may not want growth, but they might want sustainable dividends. Others would be more interested in growth. The problem is that when you have an annual production of more than 2 million ounces, it's very difficult to show material growth. Like if you wanted 20% growth, you would have to come up with like almost 400,000 ounces produced per year, in terms of, a tier one asset every year to show that kind of growth. The other thing is you offer dividends, and that's easier, or should be easier, for big companies. But what I've also seen is dividends offered by companies that have assets in geopolitically risky jurisdictions that get discounted too heavily, that they think, for where they operate. And so that like Lundin Gold and Dundee Precious, they might have growth opportunities because they've got single assets or they produce less than 1 million ounces. But in terms of just getting a better discount rate on their future cash flow, they offer more dividend yield to get their discount rate down. Agnico pays the most dividends. It's got, moderate growth, I mean, which is incredible considering, how big the company is. And then the other stocks that have growth, in terms of the way I looked at growth, was take their inferred resources and proportionate by the total mineral inventory, which would be measured, indicated, and inferred. And the average was about 25 to 30%. And the ones that, showed up well in terms of the companies that had also performed well were like Dundee, Kinross, and Lundin. And what we've seen trying to get growth through M&A, as we saw, I think we previously discussed the Equinox Calibre thing. The demand for the Newmont divestitures, they got more money than they thought they would get in 2024. We saw that, the Gold Fields and Gold Road. Right now, Gold Road doesn't want to get taken out by Gold Fields. They'll rather take out 50% of Gold Fields. Just today or yesterday, we saw Lumina Gold in Ecuador get a takeover bid. And also, I just saw that 50% of Donlin, that's held by Barrick, is getting a $1 billion bid by a group involving, I believe, the Paulson Hedge Fund. So we're seeing a lot of that come up in terms of M&A, which is exactly what we expect in this rising gold price environment.
Yeah, I think a lot of people still want to see even more, but it's very encouraging some of these big deals you just went through and some of them just happening recently. I think it's hard to ignore gold having performed so well really over the last year and a half, but also even over the course of 2025 and the margin expansion that we've seen in some of these producers. So you've got on here the expanding margins, and I'd love you to dig into how things started trending because really quarter three, we saw the misfire from Newmont, but a lot of the other companies were showing margin expansion Q4, Q1 of this year. What trends are you seeing in the margins, Joe?
So there was a strong correlation between the outperforming stocks that I mentioned and margins. And so in first half of 2024, the margins were, between all-in sustaining cost margin, and I did a range to gross margin. And so gross margin wouldn't include capital. It would just be a top line, revenue and then cost applicable to sales. And so that range was 36% to 46%. If you look at 2024, for the full year, that range went up to about 40% to 50%. The highest margin companies were some of these companies that I mentioned that outperformed. Lundin Gold, which had about a range of 65 to 75% margin, which was incredible. Dundee Precious, Torex, and then on the other side, Agnico, Alamos, and Kinross all had above peer group margins. In the mix, we include Endeavour and Eldorado Gold, but Endeavour, we know that their exposure to West Africa has probably held them back considerably. But what's driving that 65 to 75% margin at Lundin Gold is the 10.5 head grades that they got in 2024 at their Fruta del Norte underground mine in Ecuador. So, yeah, those margins definitely that had a strong correlation to performance.
So how did you account for, as much as these are gold companies, we have seen some diversification into other metals, especially copper. Did that factor in at all to any of your analysis here?
Yeah, when I say gold production, there's a bit of gold equivalence, but that gold equivalence only went to silver. So I did not include base metals. So if I were to do the EV per ounce for companies like Barrick and maybe even Dundee, it might sell them a bit short because of copper. But you could see that Barrick's leverage going forward, and it's probably already embedded in their stock, is that most of their growth is copper. Reko Diq is a copper gold project in Pakistan, but dominantly copper. Their expansion at Lumwana in Zambia, also copper. It's gotten to the point they would like to change their name from Barrick Gold to just Barrick and not have the gold moniker on it. Once you take the gold moniker off yourself, you might tend to show, you might not be on everybody's hit list for a gold company. But that's playing into their strategy. So we shouldn't be surprised if Barrick has less leverage to gold going forward, giving their overarching strategy for more copper exposure.
Yeah, that has been interesting to watch with Barrick and their focus on copper. And some people tease and they may go to Barrick Metals instead of Barrick Gold or just plain Barrick. So it's going to be interesting to see how they perform amongst their peer group that have that more gold focus when people are searching for gold stocks. But the reason they're searching is because it's undeniable the sector is making a lot of money. Question, Joe, is when you did your research, where was that money going? How much on G&A? How much is exploration? What about strategic positions in other companies or building projects? Where's the money going?
So I lo also looked at a proportion of revenue. I looked at three cost items: G&A, exploration, and financing costs. And so the ones that managed their costs very well in terms of those companies that outperformed were definitely Alamos, Torex, and Agnico. So Agnico performed the best out of the majors in terms of controlling their cost profile to under well under 10% of their total revenue with respect to G&A, exploration, and financing costs. Lundin had the highest overall costs of G&A, financing, and exploration because they had a one-time financing cost that they took in their income statement that was related to eliminating their stream and offtake facility, which the market took that as a positive. Another one that had a high overall cost was Dundee Precious, but that's because they were spending a lot of money on exploration. And that exploration was translating to growth because a lot of it was to their Coka Rakita Gold Skarn project in Serbia, which would be part of the growth story. So both of those increasing costs, above peer group averages, were met positively by the market because it fit into what the market wanted. The market wanted growth. They got it from Dundee with exploration. With Lundin, they wanted more leverage to gold. They get rid of the stream and the offtake facility. So it makes perfect sense.
So why don't these guys start spending more money, not necessarily on G&A, but in terms of either exploration, financing, new builds, or M&A, or quite frankly, returning money to shareholders? I feel like these stocks need to choose a path here. They need to either be growth stocks or income stocks. And right now, if they're not out there acquiring, I realize it's hard to truly scale up, but let's see some growth. Let's see them move forward some of the projects in their pipeline to build them a little bit faster or return some more money to shareholders. A lot of these companies have managed their debt. They're building up cash. Why not give something back to shareholders?
So what I've seen in terms of growth versus income, in terms of the valuations and the performance, it didn't really matter which stock you were. like which strategy you were going for. What mattered the most, it seemed, was how well you executed that strategy. So, a lot of these companies have like a history of meeting production and cost guidance, always meeting it. So, such that they get a premium because they always meet it. And when you don't meet it, which some companies have failed to meet their production and cost guidance, and sometimes they don't even meet their restated guidance, they get a discount. I mean, the same thing happened when I was at Newmont in the 2000s. We missed a quarterly guidance. And that discount on future forecasts keep going for several quarters until you have several quarters or more of meeting guidance. So the fact that some of these companies have 5 to 8 years of consistently meeting guidance and doing what they say they're going to do puts a lot more merit in terms of that strategy. So you might have a strategy that says, oh, we're going to grow, we're going to offer dividends, we're going to do all this stuff. But then they look at history saying, well, you've never been able to achieve that. So whatever you're telling me, I'm going to cut that by 50%. But if you've always been able to do that, whether it's growth or dividends or whatever that strategy is, if you've got a history of achieving it, you get a premium. And that's why Agnico, who don't have the same production profile as a Newmont or a Barrick, have continued to outperform them.
Yeah, it's a good point. The companies that are fiscally sound and can show that track record of doing what they said they're going to do and meeting guidance do get the premium, like Agnico. When you look at the investor lay of the land, though, and who is investing in these larger companies, it sometimes differs a little bit from who invest in the juniors. Do you think to those kind of investors that are in these larger senior companies that a dividend's more important? Is the share buybacks more important? Or would you rather see them investing in growth? Because I don't know how many people get into mining stocks for a dividend yield. We're going to talk to oil and gas stocks later in this weekend show, and they pay 6, 8, 10% yields on their dividends, and they do have that track record of making it. So I think if people want dividends, they tend to radiate there. But are there people that want dividends in gold stocks, Joe? And are they more interested in share buybacks or growth?
I would say the generalists, not the institutional equity that are resource, focused, more generalists, they would be interested in dividends. They would be interested in the liquidity these big companies offer. But that dividend has to be sustainable. You can't go back and forth. You can't have a big hiccup with your capital expenditures and cut your dividend the next year. And Newmont had these issues, pre-merger with Newcrest, where they raised their dividends, and then when they blew out their share structure because they acquired Newcrest in an all-share deal, they lowered their dividends because they couldn't possibly make that same payout on that increase in outstanding shares. So, a consistency is what people are looking for if they're a generalist looking at dividends. And so that's probably the issue that generalists would have looking for dividends from a resource company that's more focused on gold. They wouldn't have a problem, with a dividend from a Rio Tinto or a BHP or a Vale, maybe, but they maybe have a problem with doing it off a gold-only stock, given the volatility of the gold price and, the high cost of capital building these projects. So I would say that now there's an increased focus on growth, but as I said, a lot of these companies cannot grow materially. And even when they acquire, they're just setting the bar higher. So if they're a 2 million ounce producer and suddenly they're a 4 million ounce producer, the ability to replace reserves, let alone grow, just becomes harder and harder with these depleting assets. And so geologically, it's hard to find deposits that big that are gold dominant. Hence the reason a lot of these companies are, veering more to the porphyries, which tend to have more copper, because they're bigger tonnage, they have longer mine lives, and they could set you up to produce, 300,000 to 400,000 ounces a year, but they'll also take a significant amount of copper.
Interesting. That's a good point, Joe. But it's one of those things like energy companies, right? They can have $100 million of free cash flow, and at the end of the year, they're going to have maybe $3-4 million on their balance sheet because they're investing in sustaining their production, growing their production, and then also returning money to shareholders. From the balance sheet perspective, is there something else these gold companies can do? I get it that it can be hard to consistently grow gold production or any metals production because of how labor intensive, capital intensive it is to actually mine these metals. But what about either A, holding some of these metals on their balance sheet, providing a bit of diversification there, or going downstream, trying to find other verticals, other ways to build out, who knows, refineries. We keep hearing that we need more refineries in North America, or any sort of vertical integration that these companies could separate themselves from being simply just a miner, pulling a metal out of a ground and then immediately selling that.
So usually, I mean, in terms of gold, since you produce a product at the mine site that's 99.8% gold, and you send it to a refiner to get it to 99.999999%, you know, there's not much value add in the refining margin. You know, there's more of a value add in doing maybe coins or something like that. And I think First Majestic was looking into that. But most companies, they produce a fungible product with respect to a gold bar. And that's pretty close to the end game. But it's different for copper and base metals and almost every other kind of metal, is that you usually produce an intermediate product at the mine. And then the smelter and the refinery becomes an issue. Most copper companies and diversified miners got out of the smelting refining business because they didn't think the margin was there. But now, you know, most of the smelting refining capacity obviously is in Asia, and 50% of the total is in China. And so, and now that we're dealing with all these issues about tariffs and protecting one's industry, and, you know, in the US, copper tariffs and that, you know, but they lack the smelting capacity. And so do companies go and look at now increasing the ability to smelt within the States? I think there'll be a bit of that, but I think also new technologies like the Nuton technology with Rio Tinto and some other ones like the Albion process, looking at leaching concentrates or leaching things with on a heap leach, the sulfides, to get copper directly, getting copper cathode directly versus sending it to a smelter. You know, those sort of plans make more sense right now than they did previously.
Well, Joe, one more area of the study that I think it'd be great to get into with you is, since these were mostly on the gold producers, their valuations. When you look at how the gold stocks by way of the GDX are being valued, again, it still hasn't, it just barely got up over its 2020 peak recently, the GDX did, and it's still not even at its 2011 peak. GDXJ just this last week finally got above its 2020 peak. So even though gold has added on $1,200, $1,300, you know, as of today, to what it was, what, you know, what the gold was back in 2020, and the margins are significantly higher, the valuations don't seem to be there. But some of these companies you're looking at are the best in breed. So how did the valuations look when you dove under the hood?
Well, I'd say, like, the for those 21 companies, the average EV per ounce for reserves was about $570 per ounce. And then it was about half that for total mineral inventory, which would be measured, indicated, inferred. It's about $275 per ounce. And the best performer, you know, risky because single asset, risky because it's in Ecuador, in the jungle, Lundin Gold. But then you go back and they have the best margin as well. And so they have the highest valuation. Other ones that have high valuations because they not only produce gold, they control their balance sheet, they control their costs, they have a history of meeting expectations with respect to production costs and guidance, are your Agnico, your Alamos, and less so your Kinross, as, you know, and that's all wrapped around jurisdiction as well, because a lot of these companies are offering a much better jurisdiction profile, let's say, than a Barrick that has, you know, assets in West Africa. They continue to have problems in Mali. Their growth is copper, and that copper growth is Zambia and Pakistan. I mean, in terms of valuations, even though Torex and Dundee have done well on an EV per ounce basis, they're still sitting like under the peer group, Probably because Torex is a single asset producer in Guerrero. Apparently, people like Ecuador more than Guerrero, Mexico. And then Dundee's assets are in Eastern Europe, Bulgaria. And then they have their growth. Coca Rakita is in Serbia. And they have that other project in Ecuador. So, yeah, there's a bit of geopolitical risk taint on some of this stuff. But if you like knock it out of the park with respect to margins, offer people ridiculous dividends, and continue to generate a lot of free cash flow like Lundin, you will get rewarded in the market.
Fair enough. Markets can be efficient in that way. Hey, if it sounds like if you're a better miner, if you do have better margins, you will get rewarded. When it comes to valuations, though, did you look back in history? How do current valuations relate to other market times, really broadly for the gold sector?
Well, I mean, if we look at a price to net asset value, back when I worked for Newmont and the M&A was hot and people would pay, a lot more for an asset than it was worth, the idea was that the gold price would keep going up. And so people were valued at 2x price to net asset value, which seems ridiculous because most base metal assets are sort of valued at almost 0.5 or 0.6. So that option value on gold was what was embedded in that. We haven't seen that a lot, over the last several years. But now, as I showed or talked about prior, is that in Q1 2025, we did see the leverage these stocks are offering to the gold price as institutional equity generalists, and everywhere you look, I mean, you go on MSNBC and all these, even, basic non-finance news shows, they're talking about gold. Everyone's talking about gold. And so when people talk about gold, then you go through, okay, what do I want to own? Do I want to own gold? Okay, so I'm going to buy gold. Do I buy a gold coin? Or do I want leverage to gold? Like, where do I get leverage? Okay, I can buy, gold equities. Do I buy a gold equity ETF? Do I buy a royalty company? Do I buy one of the majors? Do I take a chance on growth with an intermediate that's got a higher risk profile? All of that sort of is trickling down, over the last couple of months, to potentially more of the sector we're focused in on.
Joe, you brought up royalty companies there. Did you happen to look at how royalty companies fared versus the gold producer? Because they have gold equivalent ounces, the royalty companies and streaming companies. But did you do any comparisons between the two?
Yeah, well, the thing is that they blow away most of the producers because that capital and operating cost escalation risk and the ability to show diversification with respect to the asset profile, it's hard to beat. As well as people probably believe their dividends are more sustainable than some other producers. And so their valuations are prime versus these ones. So I didn't want to dilute the producers with the valuation of the royalty companies because they do get valued higher. Such that I would say now the producers, the big producers, their competition may not be the gold equity ETF or the gold price anymore. It might be the royalty companies.
Interesting. Well, the royalty companies, they're in a totally different world, especially when you look at margins and, as you said, their costs. They can control their costs way, way easier. All
But
this
hang on a
research.
second. Just one more thing. So we talk about the royalty companies, and then today, we had a big positive in the portfolio. We had Orogen Royalties getting taken out by Triple Flag, for $2 a share. 37 cents is a spin out, but most of it is for that 1% NSR on the Silicon Merlin project in Nevada, operated by AngloGold Ashanti. So these royalties are getting highly valued. So that's just sort of a testimony to that.
Yeah, hey, Origin, that's a takeout at all-time highs. So M&A, it's been in this sector now for a little while, and it does seem to be picking up steam to a certain extent. Joe, at the end of all this research then, did anything really stand out to you in terms of what the best miners are in the space? Which companies have some of the best forward guidance? Which companies have been the most successful at controlling costs, at doing whatever? Any major standouts you can leave us with?
Yeah, absolutely. Like in terms of the majors, Agnico, stands out, and then below that would be Kinross. And so it's not the bigger production is what people are looking for. It's basically a combination of margin, controlling your costs, and meeting your guidance and controlling your balance sheet and not doing any very stupid dilutive M&A. And these companies have been able to show that. And then jurisdiction helps. Like, where are your assets and your growth located? And so those are the companies that have done really well. Alamos had done a really good job, because geopolitically at one point they were overexposed to Turkey and Mexico, and now most of their exposure is in Ontario, with the Island Gold Mine, and they bought Argonaut and for the Magino deposit. So that's helped them out a lot. So you can see when you go, it's not just, oh, growth, it's not just dividends. It's a combination of factors that underpin why some stocks outperform others.
Yeah, fair enough. Also, consistency, it sounds like. You know
Oh yeah,
what? The
consistency is huge.
ones that are just the better miners that run their businesses better, they perform better. I guess that's the big takeaway, isn't it, Joe? So stick with quality. I think
Well,
that's the quality.
I would say, like your comment on sticking with quality, like after the first half of 2024, I would have said, Agnico was overpriced. I would have said, compared to its peer group, I would have said maybe Lundin was overpriced, but this value proposition, in a higher gold price just keeps getting better. And people like a safe proposition. They don't want to take that risk on somebody that's operating in a country they don't want to be in, or operating a high-risk asset or something like that. They would rather pay up a premium, knowing that they get what they want, as well as, further leverage to the gold price. And these companies have shown that, and the investors have reflected that in their shareholder returns over that period.
Joe, great having you on the show. This has been so informative. Again, Joe Mazzumdar, our editor of Exploration Insights. Highly recommend checking out Joe's newsletter if you want to stay on top of this sector, especially the equities and all the site visits that Joe goes on to. It's great having you on the show, Joe. Thank you very much for spending time with us on this weekend show. Everyone, stick around. We are going to be right back, shifting our focus now to the energy sector.
Al Corlin's firm, AB Corlin and Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.